Chapter 34, Mansion of Eternity. Have you ever climbed a pyramid at night, fearful of arrest, with your nerves in shreds? It's a surprisingly difficult thing to do, especially where the Great Pyramid is concerned. Even though its top 31 feet are no longer intact, its presently exposed summit platform still stands more than 450 feet above ground level. It consists, moreover, of 203 separate courses of masonry, with the average course height being 2.25 feet. Averages don't tell you everything, as I discovered soon after we began the climb. The courses turned out to be of unequal depth, some barely reaching knee level, while others came up almost to my chest and created formidable obstacles. At the same time, the horizontal ledges between each of the steps were very narrow, often only a little wider than my foot, and many of the big limestone blocks, which had looked so solid from below, proved to be crumbling and broken. Somewhere around 30 courses up, Santha and I began to appreciate what we'd let ourselves in for. Our muscles were aching, and our knees and fingers stiff and bruised. Yet we were barely 1/7 of the way to the summit, and there were still more than 170 courses to climb. Another worry was the vertiginous drop steadily opening beneath us. Looking down along the ruptured contours that marked the line of the southwestern corner, I was taken aback to see how far we had already climbed, and experienced a momentary, giddying presentiment of how easy it would be for us to fall, head over heels like Jack and Jill, bouncing and jolting over the huge layers of stone, breaking our crowns at the bottom. Ali had permitted a pause of a few moments for us to catch our breaths, but now he signaled that we should press on and began to climb again. Still using the corner as a guideline, he rapidly disappeared into the darkness above. Somewhat less confidently, Santa and I followed. Time and motion. The 35th course of masonry was a hard one to clamber over, being made of particularly massive blocks much larger than any of the others we'd so far encountered except those at the very base, and estimated to weigh between 10 and 15 tons apiece. This contradicted engineering logic and common sense, both of which called for a progressive decrease in the size and weight of the blocks that had to be transported to the summit as the pyramid rose ever higher. Courses 1 to 18, which diminished from a height of about 55.5 inches at ground level to just over 23 inches at course 17, did obey this rule. Then suddenly, at course 19, the block height rose again to almost 36 inches. At the same time, the other dimensions of the blocks also increased, and their weight grew from the relatively maneuverable range of 2 to 6 tons that was common in the first 18 courses to the more ponderous and cumbersome range of 10 to 15 tons. These, therefore, were really big monoliths that had been carved out of solid limestone and raised more than 100 feet into the air before being placed faultlessly in position. To have worked effectively, the pyramid builders must have had nerves of steel, the agility of mountain goats, the strength of lions, and the confidence of trained steeplejacks. With the cold morning wind whipping around my ears and threatening to launch me into flight, I tried to imagine what it must have been like for them, poised dangerously at this and much higher altitudes, lifting, maneuvering, and positioning exactly an endless production line of chunky limestone monoliths, the smallest of which weighed as much as 2 modern family cars. How long had the pyramid taken to complete? How many men had worked on it? The consensus amongst Egyptologists was 2 decades and 100,000 men. It was also generally agreed that the construction project had not been a year-round affair, but had been confined, through labor force availability, to the annual 3-month agricultural layoff season imposed by the flooding of the Nile. As I continued to climb, I reminded myself of the implications of all this. It wasn't just the tens of thousands of blocks weighing 15 tons or more that the builders would have had to worry about, year in, year out, The real crises would have been caused by the millions of average-sized blocks weighing, say, 2.5 tons, that also had to be brought to the working plane. The pyramid has been reliably estimated to consist of a total of 2.3 million blocks. Assuming that the masons worked 10 hours a day, 365 days a year, the mathematics indicate that they would have needed to place 31 blocks in position every hour, about one block every 2 minutes, to complete the pyramid in 20 years. Assuming that construction work had been confined to the annual 3-month layoff, the problems multiplied. 4 blocks a minute would have had to be delivered, about 240 every hour. Such scenarios are, of course, the stuff construction managers' nightmares are made of. Imagine, for example, the daunting degree of coordination that must have been maintained between the masons and the quarries to ensure the requisite rate of block flow across the production site. Imagine also the havoc if even a single 2.5-ton block had been dropped from, say, the 175th course. The physical and managerial obstacles seemed staggering on their own. But beyond these was the geometrical challenge represented by the pyramid itself, which had to end up with its apex positioned exactly over the center of its base. Even the minutest error in the angle of incline of any one of the sides at the base would have led to a substantial misalignment of the edges at the apex. Incredible accuracy, therefore, had to be maintained throughout, at every course, hundreds of feet above the ground, with great stone blocks of killing weight. Rampant stupidity. How had the job been done? At the last count, there were more than 30 competing and conflicting theories attempting to answer that question. The majority of academic Egyptologists have argued that ramps of one kind or another must have been used. This was the opinion, for example, of Professor I.E.S. Edwards, a former keeper of Egyptian antiquities at the British Museum, who asserted categorically only one method of lifting heavy weights was open to the ancient Egyptians, namely by means of ramps composed of brick and earth, which sloped upwards from the level of the ground to whatever height was desired. John Baines, professor of Egyptology at Oxford University, agreed with Edwards' analysis and took it further. As the pyramid grew in height, the length of the ramp and the width of its base were increased in order to maintain a constant gradient, about 1 in 10, and to prevent the ramp from collapsing. Several ramps approaching the pyramid from different sides were probably used. To carry an inclined plane to the top of the Great Pyramid at a gradient of 1 in 10 would have required a ramp 4,800 feet long and more than 3 times as massive as the Great Pyramid itself. With an estimated volume of 8 million cubic meters, as against the pyramid's 2.6 million cubic meters. Heavy weights could not have been dragged up any gradient steeper than this by any normal means. If a lesser gradient had been chosen, the ramp would have had to be even more absurdly and disproportionately massive. The problem was that mile-long ramps reaching a height of 480 feet, could not have been made out of bricks and earth, as Edwards and other Egyptologists supposed. On the contrary, modern builders and architects have proved that such ramps would have caved in under their own weight if they'd consisted of any material less costly and less stable than the limestone ashlars of the pyramid itself. Since this obviously made no sense, besides, where had the 8 million cubic meters of surplus blocks been taken after completion of the work? Other Egyptologists had proposed the use of spiral ramps made of mud brick and attached to the sides of the pyramid. These would certainly have required less material to build, but they would also have failed to reach the top. They would have presented deadly and perhaps insurmountable problems to the teams of men attempting to drag the big blocks of stone around their hairpin corners, and they would have crumbled under constant use. Most problematic of all, such ramps would have cloaked the whole pyramid, thus making it impossible for the architects to check the accuracy of the setting out during building. But the pyramid builders had checked the accuracy of the setting out, and they had got it right, because the apex of the pyramid was poised exactly over the center of the base. Its angles and its corners were true. Each block was in the correct place, and each course had been laid down level, in near-perfect symmetry, and with near-perfect alignment to the cardinal points. Then, as though to demonstrate that such tour de force of technique were mere trifles, the ancient master builders had gone on to play some clever mathematical games with the monument's dimensions, presenting us, for example, as we heard in chapter 23, with an accurate use of the transcendental number pi in the ratio of its height to its base perimeter. For some reason, too, it had taken their fancy to place the Great Pyramid almost exactly on the 30th parallel at latitude 29 degrees, 58 minutes, 51 seconds. This, as a former Astronomer Royal of Scotland once observed, was a sensible defalcation from 30 degrees, but not necessarily in error. For if the original designer had wished that men should see with their body rather than their mental eyes the pole of the sky from the foot of the Great Pyramid at an altitude before them of 30 degrees, he would have to take account of the refraction of the atmosphere, and that would have necessitated the building standing not at 30 degrees, but at 29 degrees, 58 minutes, 22 seconds. Compared to the true position of 29 degrees, 58 minutes, 51 seconds, this was an error of less than half an arc minute, suggesting once again that the surveying and geodetic skills brought to bear here must have been of the highest order. Feeling somewhat overawed, we climbed on, past the 44th and 45th courses of the hulking and enigmatic structure. At the 46th course, an angry voice hailed us in Arabic from the plaza below, and we looked down to see a tiny, turbaned man dressed in a billowing kaftan. Despite the range, he had unslung his shotgun and was preparing to take aim at us. The Guardian and the Vision. He was, of course, the guardian of the pyramid's western face, the patrolman of the fourth cardinal point, and he had not received the extra funds dispensed to his colleagues of the north, east, and south faces. I could tell from Ali's perspiration that we were in a potentially tricky situation. The guard was ordering us to come down at once so that he could place us under arrest. This, however, could probably be avoided with a further payment, Ali explained. I groaned. Offer him 100 Egyptian pounds. Too much, Ali cautioned. It will make the others resentful. I shall offer him 50. More words were exchanged in Arabic. Indeed, over the next few minutes, Ali and the guard managed to have quite a sustained conversation up and down the southwest corner of the pyramid at 4:40 in the morning. At one point, a whistle was blown. Then the guards of the southern face put in a brief appearance and stood in conference with the guard of the western face, who had now also been joined by two other members of his patrol. Just when it seemed that Ali had lost whatever argument he was having on our behalf, he smiled and heaved a sigh of relief. "You will pay the extra 50 pounds when we have returned to the ground," he explained. "They're letting us continue, but they say that if any senior officer comes along and sees us, they will not be able to help us." We struggled upwards, in silence, for the next 10 minutes or so, until we'd reached the 100th course, roughly the halfway mark, and already well over 250 feet above the ground. We gazed over our shoulders to the southwest, where a once-in-a-lifetime vision of staggering beauty and power confronted us. The crescent moon, which hung low in the sky to the southeast, had emerged from behind a scudding cloud bank and projected its ghostly radiance directly at the northern and eastern faces of the neighboring second pyramid, supposedly built by the fourth dynasty pharaoh Khafre, Khafrin. This stunning monument, second only in size and majesty to the Great Pyramid itself, being just a few feet shorter and 48 feet narrower at the base, appeared lit up, as though energized from within by a pale and unearthly fire. Behind it, in the distance, slightly offset among the dark desert shadows, was the smaller pyramid of Menkaure, Mycerinus, measuring 356 feet along each side and some 215 feet in height. For a moment, against the glittering backdrop of an inky sky, I experienced the illusion of being in motion, of standing at the stern of some great ship of the heavens and looking back at two other vessels which seemed to follow in my wake, strung out in battle order behind me. So where was this convoy going, this squadron of pyramids? And were the prodigious structures all the work of megalomaniac pharaohs, as the Egyptologists believed? Or had they been designed by mysterious hands to voyage eternally through time and space towards some as yet unidentified objective? From this altitude, though the southern sky was partially occluded by the vast bulk of the Pyramid of Khafre, I could see all the western sky as it arched down from the celestial North Pole towards the distant rim of the revolving planet. Polaris, the pole star, was far to my right in the constellation of the Little Bear. Low on the horizon, about 10 degrees north of west, Regulus, the poor star of the imperial constellation of Leo, was about to set. Under Egyptian skies. Just above the 150th course, Ali hissed at us to keep our heads down. A police car had come into view around the northwestern corner of the Great Pyramid and was now proceeding along the western flank of the monument with its blue light slowly flashing. We stayed motionless in the shadows until the car had passed. Then we began to climb again, with a renewed sense of urgency, heading as fast as we could towards the summit, which we now imagined we could see, jutting out above the misty pre-dawn haze. For what seemed like 5 minutes, we climbed without stopping. When I looked up, however, the top of the pyramid still seemed as far away as ever. We climbed again, panting and sweating, and once again the summit drew back before us like some legendary Welsh peak. Then, just when we'd resigned ourselves to an endless succession of such disappointments, we found ourselves at the top, under a breathtaking canopy of stars, more than 450 feet above the surrounding plateau, on the most extraordinary viewing platform in the world. To our north and east, sprawled out across the wide sloping valley of the River Nile, lay the city of Cairo, a jumble of skyscrapers and flat traditional roofs, separated by the dark defiles of narrow streets and interspersed with the needlepoint minarets of 1,001 mosques. A film of reflected street lighting shimmered over the whole scene, closing the eyes of modern Cairenes to the wonder of the stars, but at the same time creating the hallucination of a fairyland, illuminated in greens and reds and blues and sulphurous yellows. I felt privileged to witness this strange electronic mirage from such an incredible vantage point, perched on the summit platform of the last surviving wonder of the ancient world, hovering in the sky over Cairo, like Aladdin on his magic carpet. Not that the 203rd course of the Great Pyramid of Egypt could be described as a carpet, measuring just under 30 feet on each side, as against the monument's side length of around 755 feet at the base, it consisted of several hundred waist-high limestone blocks, each of which weighed about 5 tons. The course was not completely level. A few blocks were missing or broken, and rising towards the southern end, there were the substantial remains of about half an additional step of masonry. Moreover, at the very center of the platform, someone had arranged for a triangular wooden scaffold to be erected, through the middle of which rose a thick pole just over 31 feet long, which marked the monument's original true height of 481.3949 feet. Beneath this, a scrawl of graffiti had been carved into the limestone by generations of tourists. The complete ascent of the pyramid had taken us about half an hour, and it was now just after 5 a.m., the time of morning worship. Almost in unison, the voices of 1,001 muezzins rang out from the balconies of the minarets of Cairo, calling the faithful to prayer and reaffirming the greatness, the indivisibility, the mercy, and the compassion of God. Behind me, to the southwest, the top 22 courses of Khafre's pyramid, still clad with their original facing stones, seem to float like an iceberg on the ocean of moonlight. Knowing that we could not stay long in this bewitching place, I sat down and gazed around at the heavens. Over to the west, across limitless desert sands, Regulus had now set beneath the horizon, and the rest of the lion's body was poised to follow. The constellations of Virgo and Libra were also dropping lower in the sky, and much farther to the north, I could see the great and little bears slowly pacing out their eternal cycle around the celestial pole. I looked southeast across the Nile Valley, and there was the crescent moon still spreading its spectral radiance from the bank of the Milky Way. Following the course of the celestial river, I looked due south. There, crossing the meridian, was the resplendent constellation of Scorpius, dominated by the first magnitude star Antares, a red supergiant, 300 times the diameter of the sun. Northeast, above Cairo, sailed Cygnus the Swan, his tail feathers marked by Deneb, a blue-white supergiant, visible to us across more than 1,800 light-years of interstellar space. Last but not least, in the northern sky, the dragon Draco, coiled sinuously among the circumpolar stars. Indeed, 4,500 years ago, when the Great Pyramid was supposedly being built for the fourth dynasty pharaoh Khufu, Cheops, one of the stars of Draco had stood close to the celestial North Pole and had served as the pole star. This had been Alpha Draconis, also known as Thuban. With the passing of the millennia, however, it had gradually been displaced from its position by the remorseless celestial mill of the Earth's axial precession, so that the pole star today is Polaris in the Little Bear. I lay back, cushioned my head in my hands, and gazed directly up towards the zenith of heaven. Through the smooth, cold stones I rested on, I thought I could sense beneath me, like a living force, the stupendous gravity and mass of the pyramid. Thinking like giants. Covering a full 13.1 acres at the base, the Great Pyramid weighed about 6 million tons, more than all the buildings in the square mile of the City of London added together, and consisted, as we've seen, of roughly 2.3 million individual blocks of limestone and granite. To these had once been added a 22-acre mirror-like cladding consisting of an estimated 115,000 highly polished casing stones, each weighing 10 tons, which had originally covered all four of its faces. After being shaken loose by a massive earthquake in AD 1301, the majority of the facing blocks had subsequently been removed for the construction of Cairo. Here and there around the base, however, I knew that enough had remained in position to permit the great 19th century archaeologist, W. M. Flinders Petrie, to carry out a detailed study of them. He'd been stunned to encounter tolerances of less than 1/100th of an inch, and cemented joints so precise and so carefully aligned that it was impossible to slip even the fine blade of a pocket knife between them. Merely to place such stones in exact contact would be careful work, he admitted, but to do so with cement in the joint seems almost impossible. It is to be compared to the finest optician's work on a scale of acres. Of course, the jointing of the casing stones was by no means the only almost impossible feature of the Great Pyramid. The alignments to true north, south, east, and west were almost impossible. So too were the near-perfect 90-degree corners and the incredible symmetry of the four enormous sides, and so were the engineering logistics of raising millions of huge stones hundreds of feet in the air. Whoever they had been, therefore, the architects, engineers, and stonemasons who had designed and successfully built this stupendous monument must indeed have thought like men 100 feet tall, as Jean-François Champollion, the founder of modern Egyptology, had once observed. He had seen clearly what generations of his successors were to close their eyes to. That the pyramid builders could only have been men of giant intellectual stature. Beside the Egyptians of old, he had added, we in Europe are but Lilliputians.